with episode 67 of Bike Live in a week where Marc Márquez won a sensational shootout at Assen. Wait, did someone say shootout? It's coming home. It's coming home. It's coming. Football's coming home. It's coming home. It's coming home. It's coming. Football's coming home. Everyone seems it to certainly know is coming home, folks. Welcome to episode 67 of Bike Life here on Motorsport 101, and not to miss the opportunity for a completely blatant open goal based on what happened in the football last night as we speak to you. England finally won another penalty shootout, so we are going to talk about this at every possible opportunity, even if this yes. isn't a football-related podcast. Yes. Welcome to all of you. Any Colombians have already switched off, but never mind. Welcome to episode 67 of Bike Live as we look back on the Dutch TT at Assen. In many ways, MotoGP went home last weekend to one of its most famous and favourite venues. And boy, did Assen deliver with one of the great MotoGP races, arguably of all time. We will discuss all of that over the next hour and a half or so. Marc Márquez winning an absolute 10 out of 10 Grand Prix in the Netherlands to extend his championship lead. So many riders, though, played such a key part in a brilliant Grand Prix, including Alex Rins, who took his career best result. We'll talk about him. The two factory Yamahas and the two factory Ducatis, who both played a very big role as well. So much went on in such a brilliant MotoGP race, and we'll break it all down over the course of this podcast. We'll also cover all the action from Moto2 as Francesco Bagnaia strengthened his Moto2 championship lead once again with a dominant victory from start to finish last weekend. And we'll look back on the Moto3 Grand Prix at Assen, although it was MotoGP that more resembled Moto3 this time. Jorge Martin returning to the top of the World Championship with his fourth victory of the year. Marco Bezzecchi finally blinks in this year's Moto3 Championship battle. We'll also look ahead to this weekend because we have a double bill of superbikes. The British Championship heads back to the newly resurfaced Knock Hill, and World Superbikes has its last round before its interminably long summer break. That is at Misano on the Rimini coast of Italy. Joining me once again to talk about all of this is Andre Harrison. Dre, it's a weird one for us recording this on a Wednesday, but it's just as well that we have one of the great MotoGP races of our time to look back on.
Rene Higuita, Carlos Valderrama, yeah. Juan Pablo Montoya. Your boys took one hell of a beating today. One hell of a beating. Sorry, I couldn't help myself. Yes, you're absolutely right. Good to be back. Sadly, I wasn't on episode 148. So apologies for that. But I'm back on Bike Live, and yeah, what a time to come back to one of the greatest MotoGP races of all time. This season was due one like that, and boy, did we get it! That was a bit special.
We'll break it down in much greater detail in just a moment. But before we do that, the places you can find us on Facebook: facebook.com/motorsport101. If you want to follow us on Twitter, at motorsport_101. Is the place to go. Our YouTube channel, youtube.com/motorsport101. Our website is motorsport101.com. And if you like us so much that you want to back us financially and earn yourself early access to both of our weekly shows, patreon.com/motorsport101 is the place. $5 backing earns you early access to both of our weekly podcasts. You basically get a link to the podcast before everybody else. If you back us at the $10 level, you have access to our Discord server, which gives you the opportunity and the ability to listen to these podcasts live as they are recorded. Episode 148 of Motorsport 101, God, we're getting close to 150, was recorded earlier this week. And it looked back on an Austrian Grand Prix. Dre, I know you weren't on it, so I guess this is your brief 30-second chance to give your two cents on what happened at the Red Bull Ring. An Austrian Grand Prix that kind of shocked us and baffled us right throughout. It was a race that went absolutely nothing like we expected it to.
Sorry, I'm too busy celebrating Sebastian Vettel's epic beat him down on Lewis Hamilton into turn two. I'm still kind of incensed over that in a good way. And maybe not so much at the stewards because of that stupid blocking penalty. But anyway, yeah.
Usually Jordan Pickford who's good at blocking penalties these days. But anyway, carry on.
Yep, quite right.
We're going to keep doing this for the whole show, listeners. Carry on.
Yes, we will. We've got the whole list of references ready to go. Oh, yeah. You see the scrolls in the background. It's about 14 feet long. But yeah, as you said, episode 148, Broken Arrow of Motorsport 101, we'll probably be live a little bit later this week. We might actually get Bike Live out first, funnily enough, because of the fact we're recording this on a Wednesday rather than our usual Thursday or Friday slot. You're all welcome. But sadly, as mentioned, I wasn't on this week's episode, but... 2 cents. This Austrian race was a complete and utter shit show, especially in the second half. Obviously, both Mercedes suffer their first double DNF, really, mechanically speaking, since they came back to the sport in 2010. Lewis Hamilton and Valtteri Bottas don't see the flag. Daniel Ricciardo suffers a DNF on his 29th birthday, the poor dude. Kimi Raikkonen very nearly steals his first win of the hybrid era since joining Ferrari. And Max Verstappen wins. Just like the form book suggested. Right. Oh, yeah, Romain Grosjean broke an 11-race cold spell by finishing fourth. Okay, as you do. All of that crazy shenanigans and much, much more on Motorsport 101 this late this week with Ryan King, RJ O'Connell, and special guest Hazel Southwell taking my spot. Hazel, don't keep the seat warm too long. I need it back for next week. But I will be back for episode 149. I can tell you that from now. Don't worry about it. I will be back for that one. But shame there's not much to talk about for next week, which is kind of a bummer. But hey, we got some corn. That'll do nicely from Iowa. And hopefully more football-related jokes.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, because there's a small matter of a British Grand Prix taking place this weekend.
I want to forget this Lewis Hamilton related shit show because we all know what's going to happen this weekend, right?
Well, don't worry because most of the people at Silverstone will too. Because while Lewis Hamilton's probably taking pole position at 3 p.m. on Saturday, the grandstands will be empty because everyone will be rushing for the nearest screen showing the football. So,
I hear they're showing it on the big screen at 3 o'clock. So, yeah, the F2 race is going to have nobody watching it at 3:45.
Yeah, which is a shame, really, given that it's probably going to be a shootout between George Russell and Lando Norris. But hey. All of that on episode 149 of Motorsport 101 to come next week. Of course, episode 148 history is just articulated to you. We'll be breaking down everything from the Red Bull Ring, which includes George Russell's victory in F2 in Austria. Right then, let's get on with the action in the Netherlands last weekend, because of course it was one of those odd weekends. You don't get them very often in a year where Formula 1 and MotoGP are both on the same weekend, but we got one last weekend. And let's talk about the two-wheel side of it and the brilliance of the MotoGP race at Assen. As you said a moment ago, Dre, we've been kind of due a race like this because we've had one absolutely crazy, stunning, incredibly entertaining and dramatic Grand Prix this season. But it was for very different reasons in Argentina. That was more of a shit show where the weather intervened, where we had the craziness on the grid, where we had Marquez and Rossi crashing into each other. We had all of the fallout from that. This one was much more, I suppose, like Phillip Island last year or Phillip Island from 2 years prior, where it was just a brilliant motor race, and basically the racing won out.
It really did. As you mentioned, like MotoGP, we were spoiled last season. Like let's not beat around the bush. We were absolutely spoiled last season with the fact that we had 6 or 7 races that could have easily been 10 out of 10 classics. We haven't really had that so far this season. We've had a handful of pretty clear winners. As mentioned, Argentina is probably the closest we've come to that, and that's mostly because of, again, as mentioned, off-grid shenanigans and the small matter of Marquez losing his mind. This time round, no, all the talking was on the track this time round, and man, did the top 8 of the MotoGP field really put on a show. Even going back as early as Saturday in the qualifying session was absolutely ridiculous, which I'm sure we'll get to right about now.
Yeah, qualifying 1, to be honest. It was not even the top 8 in qualifying 1 really gave us a show. I don't know what the history is on this. I don't know whether it did set some sort of record, but the top 6 in qualifying 1 and Assen were covered by less than a tenth of a second, which was incredible. I mean, Assen, it's not even like Assen's a particularly short lap. It's a minute 34 on race pace. I think the fastest lap in qualifying for Marquez was a high 32. And the lap record in qualifying from Valentino Rossi in 2015 is a mid 32. So it's not like it's a particularly long, it's a particularly short lap where you'd expect the time gaps to be shorter. But yeah, 96 thousandths of a second, I believe it was, covering the top 6 in qualifying. From Joan Zarco, who produced a stunning fourth sector to get himself out of Q1 and into Q2. And kind of rescued his weekend from there. All the way down to Jack Miller, of course, former winner around Assen, who was who got the rough end of that deal, ended up down in 16th on the grid. Danny Pedrosa even further back in 8th, half second off, and started 18th. 94,000ths of a second covering that top six of Zarco Rins, who we'll come back to later. That saved his weekend as well. Nakagami, Rabat, Sayarin, and Jack Miller. And Q2, as you mentioned, Dre, kind of followed on in a similar vein, because with a minute of the qualifying session to go, the checkered flag is getting unfurled, ready to be waved, ready to signal the end of qualifying. Andrea Iannone is on provisional pole ahead of Jorge Lorenzo. Tell us what happened next.
The second group is coming round right as time expires, and it's being spearheaded by Johann Zarco, who comes over the line and takes provisional pole position for about 2 seconds. I nicknamed this on Twitter. I called it Johann Zarco in how to lose 7 grid spots in 10 seconds, because that's literally what happened. Like, Zarco had a train behind him, and as they were coming over the line, we just saw a thing of dudes just set marginally faster lap times. It was very close. I believe it was half a second covering the top 11 over the line on that one. It was extremely close on that one. But yeah, like, and it all shook out in the end. Marquez took pole position, which isn't entirely a surprise, but Crutchlow snuck in 400ths behind him, and another 200ths back was Valentino Rossi, who got on the front row. Valentino continues to pull out the big guns at Assen, as he tends to do these days. So all of a sudden it shook out, and Johann Zarco, who at one point was on provisional pole, ended up starting in 8th, of course.
Yeah, and only 0.28 of a second off pole himself, and he was 8th on the grid. Again, just to show because it wasn't. And Iannone and Lorenzo, who, as I mentioned, were 1st and 2nd on the grid with a minute of qualifying to go, ended up 9th and 10th, respectively, which says it all, really. And Alex Rins, who, as I mentioned, had to go via Q1, ended up 5th on the grid. Kind of gave him the platform for what was to follow on the Sunday. Now, there was so much brilliant racing, so much incident in this race. We're going to try and go through this chronologically, and apologies if we missed some things that happened in this race, because there was so much.
There's a lot.
And we probably won't be able to cover it all as we go through it, but we picked out some key moments in this race that we're going to bring to you. And one that I didn't add to the running order, but we have to mention it, Dre, because if we're going to go chronologically through this, of course, we have to start at the start with one of the best first laps we've ever seen for the aforementioned Jorge Lorenzo, who started 10th on the grid, and by the end of lap one, he was leading it.
If anyone's got a better one, I'd like to hear it. That's ridiculous. That was utterly insane from Lorenzo. Again, he started 10th on the grid. He had a brilliant hole, like his usual brilliant launch off the line. I think he was 4th by turn 1 or 3rd by turn 1, because he went under the inside of Crutchlow in turn 2. So he was 2nd, and basically by the back end of the track down by turns 9 and 10, he was in the lead. It was unbelievable. Lorenzo had just scythed through the grid. I know the Ducatis, and particularly Lorenzo's, had a knack of being just absolutely excellent starters. But by any measure, that's utterly insane from Lorenzo. A brilliant opening lap, and it set the tone, especially for the first half of the Grand Prix, to have it like that.
I'm just watching it now, because I've got these recorded from back on Sunday, and it's incredible. If anyone has recorded this and has the chance to go back and watch it, just go back and watch Lorenzo on the run down to turn one, because a lot of it's just been purely in the launch. Like, by the time they hit the brakes for turn one, he's already 4th or 5th. He then goes clean around the outside of Rossi and Dovizioso through turn one, and then straight under Crutchlow at turn two. And those aren't 3 scrubs he's overtaking. There's two, three of the best riders in the world, and one of the best of all time he's just gone clean around the outside of through a fast right-hander. And then, as you mentioned, Ray, he then carves Marquez up halfway around the first lap as well. An incredible start to the Grand Prix from Lorenzo, who we weren't really expecting, he nor Ducati, to particularly figure at the front of the race, but they were brilliant throughout the race. The two Ducatis, they were genuinely competitive at a circuit that hasn't necessarily favoured them in the past. They've only won around Assen once in MotoGP history, and as you can probably guess, it was a Mr. C. Stoner that took that win back in the late 2010s. obviously they've come close in recent years through the likes of Petrucci, and obviously Scott Redding got on the podium there as well in a rain-affected race in Assen. But for the factory team, that's as good as they've probably gone around Assen. Now, Lorenzo continued to lead on and off through the first five laps when he came into contact, quite literally, with one of his key rivals, Valentino Rossi. Now, through the fast right-hand kink out the back of the circuit, turn 13, it has to be said, Dre, one of the great pieces of TV directing we've ever seen, in that we are literally riding on board with the tail of Jorge Lorenzo Ciccati when Valentino Rossi quite literally just basically rides straight through our TV screens.
I know there's a lot of Rossi fans out there. That's getting a little bit too close to the action. But yeah, you're quite right. I mean, apparently we could never tell from that TV angle, but apparently Lorenzo had lost the front quite badly on the previous turn and lost a lot of his momentum. The funny thing about it is that, like, whoever the TV director is, give that man a raise, because like you would never have seen that coming in a million years otherwise. He just happened to have the rear shot of Lorenzo's bike, and next thing you know, he's getting a smooch in the rear from Valentino Rossi at 140 miles an hour. Quite crazy, to say the least. But thankfully, both guys were able to continue. No major accident, which you would probably expect in something like that. But it was such a clean shot to the rear of Lorenzo's bike that they were both able to keep going, which is amazing in its own right. But yeah, we're barely tipping the iceberg on the scale of crazy for this race. But that kind of, again, it kind of set the tone, really.
Yeah, I'm sure you've probably seen the still images of the moments of impact where You can read the sponsors' letters on Valentino Rossi's letters. He's so close to your screens.
Right.
And when you slow it right down, you do see, obviously from the onboard, you can't see the front wheel of Lorenzo's because you're looking backwards, but you do see a bit of a shake because I think he hits the inside curb going through that right-hand kink, which obviously unsettles the bike, loses the front ever so slightly. Lorenzo, obviously, as Dre mentioned, loses all of his momentum, and Rossi just, obviously with nowhere to go, the only other place for him to go would have been straight off on the left-hand side, off the road, straight up the back of the Ducati, and you then saw on the slow-mo shots afterwards the kind of slightly damaged tail of Lorenzo's Ducati that he had to nurse through the rest of the race. Nothing that would slow him down particularly, but obviously Rossi and Lorenzo both had to sort of back off as a result of that. They both continued, as I mentioned. The next key incident came on lap 12, where Alex Rins started to get involved in the action. Now, Lorenzo is still leading at this point, where the battle for second is raging just behind him. Rins is emerging as a real threat through this pack and climbing up the order. And through the tight to Strubben left-hander, where Rins was doing quite a lot of overtaking, has to be said. Yeah, he was taking advantage a lot, as we'd often see riders taking quite a wide sweeping line through that corner to take the late apex, which is basically an open invitation for someone to just dive up the inside and take the early apex and get the position and try and sneak the position. Rins goes up the inside of Marc Marquez, and the two come into contact as a result of that, Dre. And whilst I don't think necessarily either rider was particularly to blame for what we saw, much like the Lorenzo-Rossi collision, both riders, in particular Marquez, were very lucky to keep going.
They were. Welcome to the weekly installment now of Marquez Makes a Monster Save. It's almost getting boring at this point. I'm lying. It's bloody ridiculous, and it will always be bloody ridiculous. But yeah, it was another one where, yeah, it was a bold move from Rins, but nothing particularly dirty or illegal about it. It was just a hard pass, and yeah, just they have to stand Marquez up a little bit, and you know, Marquez, like, his foot's off the peg. He almost loses it. He's able to save and keep going. He got duffed up a little bit there, but he was able to come back and recover. But, yeah, I mean, I don't think anyone was to blame. Race Direction had a look. They said no further action was warranted. And even Marquez himself said after the race that he didn't blame Alex Rins for that one. It was just a hard pass. He didn't see anything of it. And, yeah, they just got on with it, really. And yeah, that was kind of the spirit of this race. It was a lot like Phillip Island. It was basically a punch-up where a race might break out at the end. And yeah, again, Rins had a good hard pass there, and Marquez, you know, had another monster save. But yeah, no harm done.
Yeah, I've just sent Dre a still image on Snapchat of Marc Marquez, and you can see as he's trying to save it, he is literally hanging off the side of the bike.
I'm seeing it now, and that, oh dear God!
Like when you sort of tell yourself watching that, yeah, this guy carries on and goes on to win the race.
It didn't look that crazy in real time, but when you look at it like that from that still image, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, that's the kind of reaction, because that is literally, like, a split second later, he's on his knee. He basically uses his knee to sort of propel himself back upright again. Obviously, loses so much momentum, drops, I think, down to fifth at this stage, because the two factory Yamahas who were just behind him both just slingshot past him on the next straight, as Marquez has lost all of his momentum. Coming out of that corner, yeah, he did drop to fifth because Marquez, because Dovizioso, Vinales, and Rossi all went past him, and Marquez would still go on to recover. He would then be battling for the lead on lap 21. This is five short from the finish of this 26-lap race, with a fast closing Maverick Vinales, who had recovered from a fairly ordinary start. When has that not been the case this season? And another incident, Dre, where, again, both riders could count themselves slightly fortunate not to go off the track. Race Direction had investigated the Marquez-Rins incident and quickly decided, sod it, there's nothing wrong, let's just let these guys race. And they chose not to even investigate this one between Marquez and Vinales into the bolt, where they go into the corner side by side, the two make contact, both go wide onto the tarmac runoff, and continue dropping to third and fourth. In terms of this one, again, difficult to really apportion any blame because neither rider, you would say, did anything particularly dangerous or did anything wrong. If you had to really say anyone did anything wrong in this one, would it be perhaps that Maverick Vinales was perhaps slightly ambitious in going for a gap about half a bike wide?
Yeah, I'd say that. It's I don't know what Maverick was really thinking on that one. He was caught out by having to go the long way around on the previous corner, and as a result, there was... I mean, simply put, Marquez had basically forced him into the outside line for the next corner, and Maverick just kind of took it on anyway, which he was never going to make that pass. It's just not the sort of corner where you can pass somebody around the outside. It's virtually impossible. And yeah, they kind of both went wide there. They both kind of outbraked themselves on that one, and you know, Maverick got the worst of it really. Marquez again was able to come back, but he came back in third behind Dovi and Rossi, who were still beating the lumps out of each other at this point. Again, I don't think any punishment was worth dishing out there. Again, I think it was just a little bit of a silly error from Maverick, and I think Marquez responded a little bit by basically just outbreaking himself. Very similar to Valencia. I think he kind of just lost concentration for a second and went off the track. But again, luckily, no harm done.
Yeah, no harm done in the end. There was so much that went on in this race. There was the inter-team squabbling at Ducati, which probably ruined both of their riders' hopes of winning the Grand Prix, where Dovizioso and Lorenzo looked like they were going to take each other off at the Timber Chicane. At one point, as they fought for the lead, they were both block passing the shit out of each other. And it's very rare we get an 8-rider group at the front of a MotoGP race. We had a bigger leading group in MotoGP than we had in Moto3 this weekend, which was astonishing. But whenever we get races like this, Dre, it always tends to result in the same winner. It tends to be one rider just seems to rise above everyone else in these kind of chaotic group fights in MotoGP. It is, of course, Marc Marquez, who seems to... We spoke about this before we started. He seems to have this extra gear that he goes to late in races, in these group fights, where he's able to break the field behind him. And I can't begin to think that Marc Marquez always had that time up his hand, because surely he would have broken them earlier on. He wouldn't have allowed them to get that close and be that close throughout the race, because we saw what happened with Rins. It can easily just go wrong, because these guys will always try and pilot the inside of you. But it just seems, Dre, late in these close bunch races, Marc Marquez just always seems to find an extra level, an extra gear late in these races, which separates him from any other rider in the field.
I mentioned it earlier this year. He has a seventh gear that no one else in the field has. When Marquez is comfortable on the bike, which he clearly was this time, and he didn't have his usual practice crash, I think Heughan tried to exaggerate some of his problems. I don't think Marquez had any real issues at all this weekend. Yeah, a couple of crazy saves, but again, nothing. It's almost becoming routine for Mark at this point, as terrifying as that is to suggest. But yeah, like as you mentioned, like I mentioned this before. He has a seventh gear that no other rider in this field has. When the chips are down and he needs to win a race and he can see the opportunity to win a race in front of him, he has an extra level that no one else has. He can just bust out 0.4 out of his back pocket at will. We've seen it before. We saw it at Phillip Island. last season where, again, like, he had enough of the fight. He got to the front and he was like, okay, like, I'm going to go as fast as I possibly can, see if you can catch me. Nobody could. They were too busy still fighting each other. It happened at Jaraf earlier this year that once, you know, he got past Lorenzo, no one was able to chase him. The only guy that seemingly had half a chance was Dovi, and he didn't have the advantage necessary to pass Lorenzo like Marquez did. It's happened on numerous occasions where Marquez, once he pulls the pin, he is incredibly hard to beat. And it happened again here, like four laps to go. He takes the lead of the race from Dovi and Rossi, gets to the front, and he's like, okay, this is me at 110%. I even remember the previous all-time classic of Philip Island 2015, where he was a second down off the leader going into the final lap. And I think he just went into a mood where it was like, okay, I'm going to try and win this race, so I'm going to crash trying. And that's what happened, basically. He did it again here, and it's a sucker punch to the rest of the championship again, because it didn't really feel like Marquez was going to win that one, given how chaotic the race was until the last five laps when he gets to the front. And next thing you know, he's got three bike lengths, and next thing you know, it's over, basically. And that's what Marquez is. There's another gem in the arsenal that just makes Marquez as good as he is.
And it just goes to show how difficult he's going to be to beat in this World Championship, in that he lost a lot of his lead. Not a lot of his lead, because it was a different rider that became the nearest challenger in Rossi after the crash he had at Mugello. He has responded to that with second places at Catalunya and then this victory at Assen. He's now extended that lead to 41 points. And given that we're now entering the summer and some races that on paper will really favour Marc Marquez, you know, we know how good he is at the Sachsenring. He's nigh on unbeatable around there. It's the only circuit that probably runs Cota close for being a Marquez stronghold. We've got Austria, where Marquez has also started to go very well. He was only just beaten there by Dobby last year on what was what we thought a Ducati strong circuit. Brno, he always goes well at as well. And yeah, we're fully expecting Marquez to go well around Silverstone as well. He might have won there last year if his engine had blown up as well. We're getting into the stage of the season where Marquez tends to really perform strongly, as does the Honda, and he's already 41 clear.
He could have two races in hand by the summer break, and that would be terrifying for the field.
And more to the point, he's 41 clear, not of Andrea Dovizioso, who's probably the only rider with a bike capable of challenging. He's 41 clear of a Yamaha rider in Valentino Rossi, and I think the next three behind him in the championship are Yamahas, because you've got Vinales and Zarco up there, but none of those really have the bike capable of challenging Marquez consistently or beating him at all. So,
right,
Marquez, if he wasn't odds on favourite already for the championship, surely this one's really giving him a serious leg up.
Oh yeah, definitely, definitely. Like I said, the Sachsenring is next. Marquez is virtually unstoppable around there. He's probably going to be 50 points clear and have two races in hand by the summer break. And as you said, there's Marquez doesn't really have a bad round anymore. He's gotten the bad rounds out of the way. He's not gone well at Assen before.
Yeah,
he's won.
Well, once before, hadn't he?
Yeah, exactly. He's only won once at Assen before in 2014, when it was that weird flag-to-flag race when he beat Dovi over the line. He's only won once there before. He's only won once in Jaraf before. He won that race too. He only, I think, only had like one win at Catalunya before, and he came a solid second to Lorenzo, where his major rival did not finish. So, at least where I'm sitting, Marquez has gotten the bad rounds out of the way already. He's got three or four really good ones still to come with the Sachsenring. I'd argue Austria. I'd argue Aragon. And I'd argue Phillip Island as well. So, like, I don't think Marquez really has a bad round left on the calendar at this point. And like, it's getting to the point where they're going to have to hope Marquez falls twice to realistically have a chance, because the rest of the field is close. They're all beating each other up right now, where there is no clear, in my opinion, number two rider in this championship right now. Valentino is there purely because he hasn't binned it so far this season. Like, on pure pace alone, Rossi is not the number two guy in this championship, but through sheer power of will and not making many mistakes and taking advantages where he can get them, he's second in the championship right now. Maverick, again, as we've had major criticisms of Maverick this season, and again, he's third overall. Johann Zarco, I don't think he's been as good this year as he was last year. Again, in the top four, because he's not made any major errors. They're not title contenders the way it stands at the moment. So, the way it's going, like, Ducati need to step the right. I think right now,
they have
Dovi,
the clear number two bike in the field, don't they?
Right, and Dovi is probably the only man, realistically, at the moment that has a real shot of challenging Mark over the rest of the season. The problem is, the races that Dovi wins, who's right behind him? It's Marc Marquez 9 times out of 10. We've seen it in their 3 previous dogfights. Is that, hey, Marquez may not win, but 20 points is minimal damage to the championship the way it goes right now. Dovi's not going to win it by taking 5 points around out of Marquez on an infrequent basis. He needs chunkier damage to happen to the championship, and he's not getting it at the moment. So, yeah, like, for me, like, Marquez is supremely odds on. And I'd say it's almost match point already. If he has a couple more rounds where other major rivals make mistakes, which was what we have seen so far this season. There was Zarco at Le Mans, Dovi at Le Mans, and Catalunya, etc. Lorenzo having such a poor start to the season where he's now probably out of contention as it is now too. The way it's going, it's Marquez's to lose, and it's going to take something big for him not to win this championship for me.
Yeah, absolutely. He's 41 clear, and we're approaching the halfway stage in the season. That's the only crumb of comfort, I suppose, for the rest, is that we still have 11 races to go.
Right.
That we have the longest calendar ever, so there is time to bring him back, but there doesn't appear to be a rider-bike combination capable of challenging him. We have some good riders on... probably the best riders, say, for Marquez this year are on substandard machinery, and the best bikes are having riders on the board them that are making mistakes. And that adds up to one rider much further ahead of the rest of the championship. And in the end, he took what was a fairly comfortable victory. He was a couple of seconds clear of that crazy group behind him by the finish. But Dre, we have to talk about the man that ended up leading that second group, as it were, to take second place in the Grand Prix. We've mentioned him already. And when you look at, when you think of races like this, when you think of crazy bunch sprints, bunch battles at the front, large groups, aggressive racing, multiple overtakes, the odd physical battle on track, you don't tend to think of Alex Rins, do you? They weren't really the races that he won in Moto3. He tended to win his races by, you know, gapping guys at the front or some great last lap overtakes, tactical battles with one rider. But when we had huge groups and many, many aggressive overtakes, that never tended to favour Rins. But boy, did he stand up on Sunday and showed that he wasn't intimidated by anyone in the field. Not Marquez, not Rossi, not anyone.
Yeah, let's be frank here. Alex Rins buddied his way to that second place. He was not afraid of reputations or anything. He was brilliant into turn 5 on multiple occasions. He passed a plethora of elite level riders doing that Crutchlow. Marquez pulled off a stunning move on Maverick Viñales on the final lap to get that second place. He was phenomenal. This one of the rides of the season for me so far. This is exactly why Suzuki gave Rins that extension so quickly and wanted to tie him down for a long-term contract, because, like, it's funny, we talk about, you know, we don't associate Alex Rins with you know, these sort of tight group battles and one-on-one dogfights. The funny thing is, one, that says a lot about the state of the field, where other factories are now playing a hand in victories. I mean, we saw 5 different teams in that leading group at one point. But second of all, the point worth making here is that both times that Rins has been involved in heavy-duty pack races, the other one being Argentina, when it was a leading group of him, Crutchlow, Zarco, and Miller, Rins was on the podium that day too. It was 3 guys into 4 podium slots, and Rins was the guy that got up to the front and got there in the end for Suzuki's first podium since Maverick won that race at Silverstone a couple of years back. It's their best result since then to have Rins in second place. And yeah, a great reminder as to why Rins was signed up so quickly. That was a phenomenal ride from Rins. It looked like he'd been in the field for 5 years as a wily veteran already. This is only his second season in the top flight, and yet, you know, he looks like he belongs already as the true spearheader of the Suzuki team, because Ian Oni, his teammate, was nowhere this weekend, dropped off the leading group and never really recovered, and Rins was right there beating Maverick Viñales, who was meant to be the Marquez stopper, via a 140-mile-an-hour pass at the penultimate corner. Kind of says it all, really.
Yeah, a sensational ride from Alex Rins, who, with about 6 or 7 laps to go, looked like he'd been dropped from the lead group. We had that moment because the pace was fairly slow for a lot of the race, understandably so, given that they were always overtaking each other and slowing each other up. But there looked to be a moment with about 7 or 8 laps to go where four riders were breaking away, Marquez, Vinales, Dovizioso and Rossi, that were just starting to gap the field, and then it suddenly came back together. Around the time where we had that Marquez-Vinales tangle at the bolt, which allowed Dovi and Rossi to squeeze through, and the top four kind of shuffled around, that brought Rins and Crutchlow back into play. And boy, did Rins take advantage of it with the pace he had at the end of the race. Took his opportunities where he could get them, because of course he had the collision, or the near collision, between Dovizioso and Rossi at the start of the penultimate lap, which allowed him to gain a position. But he picked his moments. And as you say, his pass on Vinales on the final lap, reminiscent for me of the move Marquez put on Crutchlow on the final lap last year through that corner to take third place, was sensational. And again, it's rides like that, which, you know, if he can try to produce things like that on a more consistent basis, he will be every bit the rider that Suzuki think they've got, and
absolutely
will justify putting their long-term faith in him. And you know, it again just emphasises what a strong team they're going to have in the future with him alongside Joan Mir at Suzuki. And a terrific ride from Rins. A career best for him in MotoGP. Could go on to be a significant result for Suzuki, of course, because they are at risk soon of losing their concessions as a MotoGP manufacturer, because, of course, that was their first fully dry weather rostrum.
They're too good.
their second fully dry weather rostrum, because also Yone had one earlier in the year. They're getting very close to losing their concessions based on their dry weather performances, but I'm sure they'll happily give those up. It means they're competitive and challenging for podiums and wins, which it looks like they're doing now. Terrific result from Rins. Third in the end went to Maverick Vinales, who, as we mentioned, got carved up by his fellow Spaniard on the final lap, two corners out from the finish. And a result that he badly needed, Dre. I mean, I don't think necessarily this race told us that his problems are behind him, because he still dropped to eighth on the first lap. And I think in many ways he was slightly fortunate in that the pace at the front of the field was so slow because of all the overtakes that he never got dropped at the start of the race, even though he was down in eighth. So he was able to, you know, by the time he got up to speed and was able to show what great race pace he had, he wasn't far behind. He was still in the group and was able to climb his way up to the front of the group and finish third. So whilst it doesn't necessarily show us that Vinales has got all his problems behind him, nevertheless, a result that Maverick badly needed.
Yeah, ultimately points mean prizes, and Maverick, you know, there's no getting around it. Third place is, I think, the joint best result. Oh, the best result is that since Kota. He finished second that day, but it's only his second podium of the season, I think. And given Yamaha's current struggles, which have been well documented, I mean, they didn't win. This was clearly their best chance to win a Grand Prix, probably since, you know, Maverick's early form at the end, at the start of last season. Even so, I mean, third is still a solid result for Maverick. I think he'll take it in the grand scheme of things. I don't think he'll be too disappointed by that. But fact still remains, the race still highlighted the typical Maverick problems, is that he was beaten up at the end there by Alex Rins. He was cut up there and was basically outclassed at the end by a fearless Rins. But on top of that, simply put, it was another case where Maverick had a bad start and lost ground to the leading group. The blessings for Maverick in this case was because the race pace was so slow and no one could really break free till the final five laps, purely because, again, everybody was passing each other. There was 175 overtakes during this race, which, according to Matt Burt, who quite cleverly worked out, that's an overtake on average every 14 seconds during this race. 14 seconds for the average overtake on during this race. So, yeah, it's the most overtakes in a race that's been recorded since records began. So, 175 passes. So, as a pure result of that, given that most of them are in the leading group, it was going to bring riders who are normally a bit slower than this into play. And Valentino was, again, for me, the faster of the Yamahas and the more comfortable of the Yamahas this weekend. It just didn't work out for him due to the multiple incidents we had during the race where guys got duffed up. And they were punished for it. I mean, we were sorry. Rossi was in contention for the win.
He looked like he was going to be the only guy able to give chase to Marquez later on, wasn't he? Until he got duffed by Dovizioso.
Exactly. With about three laps to go, Dovi, you know, it accidentally runs Rossi wide and off the track, and he has to sit the bike up. And that was the end of Rossi's challenge for the victory. Dovi just seemed to have it in the bag after that one in terms of the fight for second. And they ended up fighting again on the final lap as a result as well. Valentino Rossi, his helmet probably more red than yellow at that point, looking for revenge. But yeah, simply put, it was that sort of race where the guy that rode the cleanest race was going to end up on top. And in this case, it was Maverick. And to a lesser degree, Alex Rins, who had the guts to pass where other guys weren't thinking of passing, that came in second. So, brilliant stuff. Brilliant stuff indeed. From you know, the Yamahas. They tried to make it competitive. I mean, Rossi was great. Maverick had similar Maverick-esque problems. But hey, third place is a step in the right direction for the team at the moment. And I think given their overall competitiveness of the weekend, I don't think Yamaha will be too disappointed. The only problem is we have the Saxon Ring and Austria next.
Yeah,
two rounds they were pretty
good. They struggled up both.
Exactly.
Last year, the Yamaha, if it has a weakness, it clearly has many of them. But it doesn't have the ultimate top-end speed of the Ducati and the Honda, which it kind of needs around Austria. And it's never particularly gone well around the Sachsenring, which is historically a Honda track. Now, as far as the Italians that we just mentioned are concerned, they finished 4th and 5th at the end, Vizioso and Rossi. I mean, it's difficult to be too critical, isn't it, Dre, of either of them? I mean, as I say, they finished 4th and 5th. Both could easily have finished higher. And they kind of slowed each other up in the end when Marquez started to break away, as they both were trying to be the one to give chase. And in the end, neither gave chase because they held each other up. But again, it was just one of those races where when you have an 8-man leading group, you're always bound to have someone who finished very close to the winner and finishes down the order. And in the end, Dovi and Rossi finished 4th and 5th purely through, again, just being wrong place at wrong place, wrong time. Would that be the best way of putting it?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to get a read on this because what we saw in Assen, we don't normally see. Like, this was a multiple bike, multiple manufacturer, multiple team dogfight. And even I remember rewatching the race in the background right now. Like, there's 6 laps to go and there's 3 seconds covering the top 8. That just doesn't normally happen. So yeah, it's hard to
really get at the end of lap 21, 5 to go, Rossi leads over the line. He gets passed into turn 1 by Dovizioso, who thus takes the lead. And neither of them finish on the podium.
Yeah. It's just that sort of race where there were so many minor incidents, so many examples of guys getting duffed up and you know, guys losing a second, 2 seconds by minor mistakes that, you know, it's... You want to read into the results, but you also know you can't really run into the results too much because it was such a crazy race of so many incidents that ultimately had an effect on the final result. That it's kind of hard to really judge on this one. I don't think Dovi or Rossi did anything particularly wrong. That was the closest Rossi's looked like to winning a race since this very Grand Prix last year.
Which was the last time.
Yeah, and Dovi, who doesn't normally go well at Assen, was the best he's looked at Assen in his MotoGP career to date. So, you know, not since the second he had in the flag-to-flag race in 2014. So, yeah, like, for me, they didn't really do anything wrong. It was just that sort of race where anything could and most likely did happen. And the result doesn't tell the full story, in my humble opinion, with that one. And like I said, Rossi could have won that race, Dovi could have won that race, and it would not have surprised me given the context of how it played out. So, yeah, they didn't do anything wrong. They were just a little bit unlucky to say they basically held each other up and, you know, tripped over each other so much. You know, it opens the door for other people. In this case, it was probably Rins and Vinales that was... the real benefactors on that scenario, because I think they weren't quite as quick as Rossi and Dovi was in this race. But as a result, you know, they've come into second and third, and they've had to settle for 4th and 5th.
In the end, we had 7 riders covered by just 4.5 seconds across the finish line at the end. And obviously, the leader of that was 2.2 clear of the next rider, so 2.5 seconds covered 2nd to 7th. Across the line. The last two riders in that group were Cal Crutchlow, who was, whenever he started to close in on the front runners, BT Sport obviously got rather excited, but he always tended to spend more of that race at the back of the group than anywhere near the front of it. I don't think he ever ran in the top 3 at any stage, did he? He was always at the back of the group and just able to stay there when the pace was slowed down. It just seemed to me, whenever the pace got quicker, Crutchlow started to fade back a bit in that race, and obviously once it slowed down, he got just towed back in again. And likewise, Jorge Lorenzo had the executive order carried out on him eventually. And he finished seventh. And he, again, similar to Crutchlow, whenever the pace really picked up, Lorenzo started to fade. And an interesting moment, I have to say, Drain, that obviously he was beaten to the flag by Dovizioso on this occasion. And it did just make me think a little bit that some people might have got a little excited. And I could understand why with Lorenzo's back-to-back wins, thinking, hey, Lorenzo's back. He's back to his best. He's clearly figured out this Ducati. Well, maybe a race like this and a result like this just maybe cools those jets a little bit and tells us that he's not quite the finished article on that bike just yet.
That was basically Le Mans for Lorenzo.
Yeah.
You know, got a brilliant start, took the lead in the early period, but once everybody else found their feet, he got duffed up and he fell back. That was a bit more like the Lorenzo we've seen before the two wins he had earlier in the season. So, yeah, it felt a lot more like that sort of race from Jorge on this one. And this was a golden chance for Lorenzo to really, you know, get another win, to get three in a row. And he put himself in the perfect position to do it. But once again, it's like once the pace picked up at the end and everyone started to push the limits of the bike and, you know, their respective bikes and get up there, Lorenzo faded. Just didn't quite have it in him to challenge for the win. But yeah, it is a little bit of a cooler in terms of the Lorenzo hype train, given, you know, how dominant he was the last two races. But again, it goes to show you more about the state of the series, where, you know, a guy can completely dominate two rounds and then go to Assen and then look, you know, a little bit second rate, given he fell behind the two leading groups that we had at the end of the race. So again, it's another compliment to the series and its competitive balance at the moment that Jorge Lorenzo finds his feet two rounds in a row and then in the third round gets stuffed up again. It's crazy how it turns out.
And much like Dovizioso, he's not got the greatest record historically around Assen either. He finished seventh ahead of Joan Zarco, who was a little bit quiet, has to be said, scraped his way out of Q1 and then ended up qualifying in the top 12, finished eighth. Ahead of Álvaro Bautista in ninth, he was only 7.5 seconds off the win himself on his Aspar / Angel Nieto Ducati. Jack Miller rounded out the top 10 ahead of Andrea Iannone, who got a 2-second penalty for shortcutting, and that cost him 10th to Miller. Paul Espargaro 12th on the KTM, ahead of his brother Aleix on the Aprilia, Scott Redding on the other Aprilia, and Danny Pedrosa took the final point on the Honda. He had a dreadful weekend, qualified 18th, finished 15th. He was 16 seconds off the race winner, 16.043 seconds, which is the shortest gap between the first and last point scorers in MotoGP Premier Class Grand Prix history. And Dre, you said a moment ago when we were talking about Lorenzo, it just goes to show how competitive the series is nowadays. Nothing exemplifies how competitive MotoGP is nowadays than the fact that the entire top 15 was covered by 16 seconds.
Yeah, the closest top finish in the history of GP motorcycle racing. We've come a long way, folks. Again, it wasn't all that long ago that we walked into a Grand Prix thinking only one of four guys was going to win a race, and they were probably going to be in orange or blue. And again, this was a wonderful showcase of how far the sport has come. Yeah, sure, Marquez won it fairly comfortably in the end, but let's not forget, in that leading group of eight, we had, you know, world titles, race winners, young, upsurgent talent under the age of 23, and guys from six different teams in the leading battle for the win, including a team on concessions and two teams on independent machinery in Zarco and Crutchlow, who, you know, are running for independent teams and do not have all the resources that Repsol Honda and, you know, the movie star Yamaha team respectively have. And Danny Pedrosa, a guy who is one of the greatest riders you've ever seen, was in 15th on the edge of the points, and he was 16 seconds off the win, which would not be disastrous in many of these races in the past. That might get you a top six a couple of years ago. So yeah, like it shows how far the series has come. It's shown that Dorna has done a brilliant job in balancing the books to a degree where the best riders and the best teams will still win, but in such a way now where every weekend feels fresh. Every weekend now feels like we don't know who's going to win necessarily. Only a handful of rounds are dead certs really on the calendar at the moment. Even Austria, which came in and first time out was a Ducati signature round, it looked like it was almost built for them. has now turned into a race where we had Marquez and Dovi fight for the win just a year on. So the way, I mean, it's amazing that all these big factories and their forms can often dip or they can shift and things can change. But yeah, the field is closer than it's ever been, and that's been wonderful to see. And again, Aston was a fantastic demonstration of just how far Dorna has come in terms of making the series more competitive and hence more entertaining.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right in that the best will still win. The cream still rises to the top, but we'll have much more entertainment and much more of a competition on the route to getting there, because you know, you just need to look at, you know, pick out four of the best races we've had in the last 4 or 5 years, and four of the best MotoGP races of all time. Misano 2015, Phillip Island 2015, Phillip Island last year, and Assen this year, all had the same winner in Marc Marquez, but that does not make them any less entertaining and any less thrilling of a race for it. They were all absolute all-time classics, even if Marc Marquez won them all. You've already heard the result. Let's give you the championship standings as they run now. With 8 races of 19 gone, Marc Marquez has 140 points. He leads Valentino Rossi by 41. Maverick Vinales is 6 points further back in third. He is now the only rider in the field now to have scored points in every single race, because Danilo Petrucci, who was the other, has no longer scored points every race. He crashed out last weekend. Joan Zarco is 4th on 81 points, 2 ahead of Dovizioso, who jumped back up into 5th. He's on 79, so he trails Marc Marquez by 61 points. Cal Crutchlow is 8th, also on 79. He and Dovizioso have both won a race each. Dovizioso is ahead of him on countback of having more seconds. Jorge Lorenzo is 7th on 75 points. Danilo Petrucci drops to 8th on 71. Yannone also on 71 after he only finished 11th. Jack Miller in 10th in the championship after finishing 10th in the race last weekend. And Alex Rins jumps up to 11th now on 53 points with his second podium of the year, ahead of Danny Pedrosa, who drops to 12th. We will have more news on him most likely on next week's edition, episode 68 of Bike Live, because he has announced a press conference for the Sachsenring where he will clarify his future either way, whether he's retiring or whether he's going to be riding a Petronas-backed Yamaha in 2019. We'll have news on that next week on the podcast, but for now, Danny Pedrosa is having a pretty trying season in 2018. Now on to Moto 2 next, and the continuing toing and froing of the championship battle between Francesco Bagnaia and Miguel Oliveira. In the last round at Catalunya, although he didn't win the race, it very much swung Oliveira's way, finishing second from way back on the grid, whilst his championship rival Francesco Bagnaia had a poor race by comparison, finished down in 8th. This time, though, it was pretty apparent, Dre, pretty much from Friday, who the man to beat was this weekend. It was Francesco Bagnaia. If you discount the morning warm-up on the Sunday, Bagnaia was quickest in every single session. Quite clearly, the dominant force at Assen.
Yeah, Pecco wins, lol. That was a astronomic weekend from Pecco Bagnaia. It never really looked like he was anything less than fastest all weekend long. He rode magnificently and did it again here. You know, took the early lead, led from the front, and no one could really go with him. And he just inched out more and more of a lead. The attempts turned into seconds. It was, I think it was just over 3 by the time it was all said. And I know Baldassare was reading him in a little bit, but we'll get to why that suddenly stopped at the end of the race. But yeah, Pecco never looked like he wasn't going to win this weekend. I know he loves Assen very much. It was the home of his first GP victory when he was riding for Mahindra in Moto3. He actually has it tattooed on his arm, believe it or not. That's how much Assen means to him. So yeah, like he loves Assen. It's, for him, it's his favorite track. It's the one he wants to win around the most, and he never looked like he wasn't going to win there. It was a flawless weekend from Pecco Bagnaia.
And just the result he needed, given that we're learning more and more about Pecco as we go this season. I mean, we all know already that he's a stunning talent. He's going to be a frontrunner in MotoGP in the future. We know he's going to be riding a Pramac Ducati next year with Jack Miller as his teammate in MotoGP. But this is the first time we've seen him compete for a world championship, because he never really had the equipment to fight for a championship in Moto3. As Dre mentioned, he's been on the Mahindra for most of his Moto3 career. So Moto2, we were waiting to see how he'd respond to that disappointment of Catalunya, where he only finished 8th. But he reacted much in the same way he reacted to his poor result back in Argentina, where he was nowhere all weekend. He came back in the next round in America and took a stunning victory, where, of course, he beat Alex Marquez on that occasion. And yet again, it's a sign of a champion, isn't it? You have a bad race, but you don't let that fester. You don't let that become two or three bad races. You strike back at the very next round and get right back on the podium again. And it just tells us once again, not just how talented and how quick Bagnaia is, but about his mental toughness. He doesn't let a bad round phase him.
Exactly. He bounced back. He's been under a fair amount of criticism after Mugello, where he dropped off the leading group and, you know, didn't really look strong. Obviously, Catalunya, where he fell to 8th and never really, looked all that great out there. But he came back this weekend, shook off the criticism and, you know, shook off the pressure from Miguel Oliveira that was starting to breathe down his neck in terms of the title race, and just completely dominated. It's that champion's mentality that Pecco showed this weekend, and yeah, he showed it in spades. It was a phenomenal performance from him.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant ride from Francesco Bagnaia. Now we'll come on to what happened immediately behind him in the race in a moment, but we'll be focusing in particular now on the championship battle, which is between him and Miguel Oliveira. They came into the race just a point apart at the top of the championship after Oliveira had closed him down in Barcelona. But we find ourselves, Dre, talking about the same old weakness with Oliveira to a certain extent, but more particularly his bike, the KTM, which we know is so good on its tyres, which makes it such a strong race bike. But again, they struggle to switch the bike on, switch the tyres on for qualifying. And what I'm seeing so often in Moto2 qualifyings, and it's been that way for a while actually, is that you'll often see a lot of the riders set their fastest times at the start of the qualifying session. Whether it's because they don't have enough new tyres to run in qualifying, or whether it's because the temperature's late in the afternoon, the track isn't at its quickest, so the best time to set a time is early on in the session. But time after time, we see Oliveira qualify poorly. For the second race in a row, he qualified 17th. And on this occasion, Dre, he wasn't able to, you know, perform a Houdini act on the first lap and get his way out of it and finish on the podium. And it's pretty clear, isn't it, that unless they solve this problem, a lack of qualifying pace is going to cost KTM this championship.
It's looking that way. I mean, James Tozen very eloquently talked about it during the race itself. He said it's a fundamental KTM problem. It's like Oliveira's race pace was solid. He was running similar pace to those around him at the front of the field, but they don't have the extra half a second that you need in qualifying trim when the chips are really down.
And half
to get
a second
the
off the pole time in qualifying in Moto2 means you're 17th.
Yeah, it could be three rows basically in terms of grid slots and in terms of where you can end up as a result of that. So yeah, it's unacceptable for KTM as a factory. They're leading the charge here, and Miguel has got a really good chance of winning this year's championship if KTM can get their qualifying gremlin sorted. They need to do something to give their rider a bit more confidence at the absolute limit in qualifying, because he clearly doesn't have that. Because this has become a trend where he's starting on row 6 or 7 when his race pace is superb. It's as good as anyone's in the field. So, just problematic from KTM, and it's just going to keep having these problems. It's just ugh.
And it's weird, because it must clearly be a fundamental problem in this year's KTM chassis, because they never had this problem last year, did they, Dre? I mean, wasn't Oliveira one? Weren't they on pole for their second ever race in Moto2 with Oliveira in Argentina last year? So it's not like the KTM has never been able to qualify. It has in the past, and what makes it especially weird is that even this year, when Oliveira's qualified badly, there always seems to be one anomaly at KTM. There always seems to be one of them that qualifies well. And this weekend, Sam Lowe's qualified 6th. And he was only he was less than 2/10 off pole with Sam Lowe's on the KTM.
Right.
And he went the other way. He dropped back in the race and finished 9th in the end. So it's not like all of the KTMs are struggling. Most of them tend to. But there always tends to be one that does all right. It's weird. I mean, like I say, I just wonder whether KTM, whether they're their strategies are wrong in qualifying, whether they're just not going out there and putting a banker lap in early, whether they're thinking that, oh, we'll qualify, we'll put our stronger lap in at the end, but the track's never in good enough shape at the end for them to put that lap in, and the damage is done. They're too far back to really do anything about it. I don't know, I'm guessing, but there are clearly issues that KTM need to work on, not just with their machine, but I also think tactically in terms of how they approach these qualifying sessions, because Sam Lowe showed it last weekend. It's not like the KTM couldn't qualify well. It did in Sam Lowe's hands, just in, no, not in anyone else's. Because, you know, the other KTMs, Lecuona was 19th, Binder was 22nd on the grid, and Dominic Agata was 21st. He was just ahead of Binder. So the other KTMs were all from 17th to 22nd on the grid. But it just seems that one of them was a little further up. Oliveira, as I mentioned, recovered to 6th at the end in the race, so he did recover some of the damage, limited the damage in the race, but that was still 15 points he lost to Bagnaia in the championship, and he now trails him by 16. Now, as promised, let's talk about what happened ahead of Oliveira but behind Bagnaia in the race, because it looked for a long time as if Lorenzo Baldassarre was going to finish 2nd at worst and perhaps put a little bit of pressure late on Bagnaia, even if he wasn't necessarily going to beat him. But unfortunately, Dre, for Baldassarre, he lost 2nd through no fault of his own, through a very unusual problem in Moto2.
A puncture. Yeah, I got nothing for you on this one. Very bizarre. I can't remember that ever happening in a Moto2 race where a guy just suddenly had a puncture and has had to, you know, run down the pits. It's not great, to say the least. It's a shame because it ruined Lorenzo's race. I mean, there was no obvious sign. Maybe he just took too much curb somewhere and the rim just, you know, the rim of the tire just fell off. It's a weird one. It's a very bizarre incident. I don't think we've got any sort of explanation as to what happened. But yeah, it's a real shame because, you know, Lorenzo was running 2nd. He was actually taking a little bit of time out of Bagnaia. I don't think it would have been enough to really challenge for the win, but it was still a very, very solid weekend for Lorenzo Baldassarre to get himself back in the title contention, and now he's even further away just purely because of something that was really out of his hands.
Because he's continuing to have a very, very good season, is Baldassarre. I mean, his position in the championship probably doesn't really do his season justice, because he's been terrific. Because, of course, he took that brilliant victory early in the season in Jerez, and he very nearly won the opening round of the season, didn't he, as well in Qatar. He has been terrific since moving to the Pons team. But yeah, unfortunately, it didn't go his way last weekend. 2nd in the end was inherited by Fabio Quartararo, who's becoming one of the stories of the summer, not just in Moto2, but in the MotoGP paddock. Because before his win, his stunning win in Catalunya, he was a rider that we would never really concentrate on in Moto2, not a rider we'd ever really talk about. But even when he won in Catalunya, we did sort of talk about his results last year and kind of mentioned them and thought, hey, actually, those results, when you kind of analyse them and consider what he was riding and how young he was, they're actually quite good results.
Yeah, they weren't bad.
But we're now, again, much like Bagnaia, we're learning more and more about Quartararo, because obviously when a rider takes his first win, when it's such a shock win like that, we're asking, well, can he back that up at the next race at Assen? Can he do it again? Can he show that wasn't a flash in the pan and that he genuinely, both he and that speed up, are genuine front-running contenders now in Moto2? And after receiving a grid penalty for not pitting under red flags in qualifying and having to start 10th, Quartararo came up with the answer, Dre.
His second half pace was scintillating. Yeah, he just carved through the second group there. It was ridiculous. We didn't see it coming until right at the end. I saw Oliveira getting passed by Quartararo. I was like, oh, hang on, is he at it again? And yeah, he was. That's exactly what happened. And yeah, he obviously took advantage of Lorenzo's puncture, but still, you know, took a comfortable second in the end. His second half pace was scintillating. And yeah, it's just proving that the speed up performance and the new chassis that he's been given, it's no fluke. Fabio looks really good now, so much so he's actually been rumoured by Speed Week to potentially be on the second Patronus back to Yamaha. We could see Quartararo in MotoGP next season. So the hype train is fully rolling with Fabio now. And yeah, scintillating performance again. And, you know, again, a fantastic bit of evidence to say that, yeah, Catalunya was no fluke. Yeah, Fabio has arrived here, people. And look out, the speed up is back.
Yeah, absolutely. A sensational result. for Quartararo. And we kind of saw it in free practice that he was looking competitive, just like he did. And you know, he seems to be riding that wave of confidence. But yeah, his second half of the race pace was scintillating, as you mentioned, because even as early as sort of half distance, he looked like he was maybe going to be sort of fringes of the top six, that sort of result, which again, given what he'd done for most of his most of his career, would have been in itself a good result. But the way he came on strong towards the end of the race was incredible. Just making light work of riders like Alex Marquez and Marcel Schrotter, who thought for a long time that they were battling between themselves for the two spots on the rostrum behind Bagnaia once Baldassare had dropped out of there. But in the end, it went to Quartararo. And, you know, Alex Marquez taking that final rostrum spot, Dre, and finishing third, but that doesn't really tell us much that we didn't already know about Alex Marquez. And it just seems, once again, that there always seems to be at least another guy that stands up and makes us take notice of them more than Alex Marquez in Moto2. Because we've seen the emergence this year of Bagnaia, we're now seeing the emergence of Quartararo, and yet again, I mean, we haven't even mentioned Joan Mir, who's already just leapfrogged him into MotoGP. The more I watch Alex Marquez, and this again wasn't a bad weekend for him. Third's not a bad result for Alex Marquez in Moto2, and he's not out of the championship fight by any means at the moment. But
right,
the more I watch Alex Marquez, the more I fear he's just going to become another Luthi that just gets lost in Moto2.
That's what I fear. I feel like he has the words gatekeeper written all over him, like the Michael Bisping of Moto2. It's not great, and like I feel bad for Marquez because he's clearly like a top-tier dude in Moto2 and has been for two or three seasons now. But the problem is that, as you say, he just doesn't have the ultimate speed to consistently fight for a championship. It's like there's always someone who's just a little bit faster than him and is a little bit more raw and just a little bit more talented, dare I say, than Alex Marquez. I mean, he's just never been able to put a full season together. And even in this case where he's finished in third, like Quartararo blew the pants off him and get to that second place. And again, Bagnaia completely dominated, and Bagnaia's championship leader for a reason. The four wins certainly helps. And Marquez doesn't have a win so far this season. Yeah, he's always
five
had
podiums,
some...
but no wins.
Yeah, five podiums. There's always been someone who's a little bit better than him at the moment. You're not going to win a championship doing that. He's drifting further away from Bagnaia now. He needs to start winning races. Otherwise, he's not going to get there. And it could be a case where MotoGP just ends up passing him by because there's always going to be someone a little bit more brighter as a prospect in the way.
Yeah, that's the fear for Alex Marquez. I mean, he's 22 years old now, is Alex Marquez. And again, we were speaking about this off air before we started about John McPhee, and we'll get onto this in Moto3 about, you know, John McPhee's 24. And if you're still in Moto3 at 24, you're not going to be in MotoGP. And
no,
22 is not old. I mean, this is a person who's 28 next month talking. So, yeah, I'm in no place to talk about people's age. But again, in Grand Prix racing terms, for riders who are, you know, on the ascent in their career and looking at a MotoGP future, if you're not in MotoGP by 22, or not at least on the verge of MotoGP by 22 and winning Moto2 championships, you kind of get the feeling that they're never going to get there. And again, that's like Dre says, this is not to take away from Alex Marquez as a rider. He is a fantastic rider. He's a Moto3 world champion. And even if he never makes it to MotoGP, he's had a terrific career. He's a multiple Grand Prix winner. He's a world champion in Moto3. But the longer it goes, the more you start to think that there isn't going to be a MotoGP future for Alex Marquez. And if there is, it will purely be for commercial and, you know, endorsement reasons because he's a Marquez. Which for me would be unfair on Alex for him to be propelled into a MotoGP class for that reason when he's perhaps not ready for it. But right. Yeah, a good result last weekend for him. But in the grand scheme of things, it kind of again told us a bit about him as a future MotoGP rider, that perhaps there are always going to be riders with more upside for a MotoGP spot in the future. Let's take you through the result then last weekend in Assen. Bagnaia, the winner, as I mentioned, from Quartararo, who took his second podium. That's the first time since early 2015 that Speed Up have had back-to-back rostrums when Sam Lowe has followed up his first victory, coated with a podium on the next round in Argentina. So, yeah, he took second in the end, ahead of Alex Marquez. Marcel Schrotter, a career best for him, that in Grand Prix racing. in fourth position. He still chases his maiden rostrum of his Grand Prix career. Fourth is now as good as he's ever been in his Grand Prix career. Joan Mir, who we didn't really notice much in the race, he finished fifth in the end. Not got a great record, Mir, around Assen. Even in his great Moto3 days, he never really had a great result around Assen. But fifth is a decent enough result for him. Ahead of Oliveira in sixth and Brad Binder seventh. So again, the KTM's good in race trim. Binder from 22nd on the grid to seventh. Luca Marini, who got his first ever front row start of the weekend, finished eighth on the second Sky BR46 Calex. Sam Lowes, who started up on the second row, finished ninth. And Andrea Locatelli finished ahead of his teammate, Mattia Pessini, for what must be the first time this year without the two of them having a crash at any stage. They were 10th and 11th. Augusto Fernandez, who's the full-time replacement now for Hector Barbera at the Pons team, 12th ahead of Jorge Navarro, 13th. Domi Agata, 14th. And Simone Corsi took the final point. In 15th position, Moto2 championship standings look like this. Bagnaia continues to lead, but he's extended his lead back out from 1 point to 16. Alex Marquez is third. He is 34 points off the lead. Baldessari has now dropped 51 back in fourth after his DNF. Joan Mir is fifth on 75, ahead of Javi Vieje, sixth on 70. Brad Binder, seventh on 66. Quartararo is now up to eighth on 65. Pessini, ninth on 63. And Schrotter, tenth, also on 63 points. Ike Lacona and Sam Lowes, the two Swiss Innovative Investors riders, are next up on 32 and 28 respectively. They are 11th and 12th. Now into Moto3. And as I mentioned, the MotoGP race resembled a Moto3 race more than the Moto3 race did in the end. But we still had a pretty good fight at the front, all things considered, Dre, in Moto3. One, for the first time in... Well, I was going to say it's back-to-back races. It took us ages to get a Moto3 winner from pole position. Now it's happened twice in as many races. Jorge Martin winning from pole. But if we go to the very start of the race into how this race unfolded, where the sort of dozen rider leading groups in Moto3 are becoming much less frequent this year. And really, we've got Jorge Martin to blame for that, because yet again, yeah, we saw this strategy from Martin at the early stages of the race where he essentially starts the race like he ends qualifying, and basically asks the rest of the field to see if they can keep up with him. And in the end, only four riders were able to keep up with him. And we were kind of grateful to Aaron Canet, weren't we, about a third of the way through that race, for bringing Jorge Martin back.
Indeed, yeah. Like Martin's been tried. He's been trying this now almost every round, especially when he started from pole position, where he's tried to break the field early and just tried to run away with it. It's only really worked once, and that was at Catalunya. And even then, well, we all know what happened at the end of that race. But yeah, he tried it again, and it didn't quite work. And I'm glad that they were able to reel him back in again and turn it into a bit more of a fight until the latter stages of the race itself. But it's a sound strategy. It's not like it's not working. It's just, you know, it's really hard to do this in Moto3.
Yeah, but and we kind of would rather he didn't.
Exactly. It's not good for entertainment purposes, Jorge. Take one for the team. Fight for it, damn it.
yeah, he just, it's incredible. It's the Jorge Lorenzo strategy of just getting up, getting the whole shot, and just bolting immediately. And yeah, it's almost, he's almost rewritten how you would go about a Moto3 race if you've got designs on winning it. But yeah, we had that amazing pace from Canet that pulled him back. Bastianini, Bezzecchi, the championship leader pre-race, and John McPhee were the only riders that were able to go with him. And in the end, Andre Martin kind of did what Marquez did in the MotoGP race later that day, in that he took the lead with 2-3 laps to go, and then, again, much like Marc Marquez, he just found that extra gear, didn't he? He took the lead at the start of lap 20, and it's a 22-lap race, so this is inside the final three laps. He got under Bastianini and Bezzecchi through those right-handers at the start of the lap, turns 2 and 3. By the end of that very same lap, he had a 0.7 lead, and the slipstream had gone.
Yeah, and that was it, effectively. Like if you end up getting caught napping, he's going to punish you. It's as simple as that, because he's got, I'd say, relative to the field, more ultimate pace in him than anyone I've ever seen in Moto3. He's the only guy that can really do this, where he can conceivably break the toe and break the field in a leading dogfight in a Moto3 race. Like, I've never seen anyone be able to do that. So he's incredible where that's concerned. Like, he just has this... He's got an extra 0.3 in his locker that no one else in Moto3 has. It's that seventh gear I was talking about. Like, Jorge Martin might be the only other guy in the field that really has that. And it showed, again, because, again, the rest of the field got caught hot-dogging, and next thing you know, Martin's gone, and the race was over, effectively.
Yeah, and it goes to show once again how, on pure talent alone, you would probably say, well, not probably, you would absolutely say that Jorge Martin is the premier rider in Moto3. And that's to take nothing away from the likes of Bezzecchi, who's done a tremendous job this season, who is, relative to Martin, much less experienced as a Grand Prix rider and is doing a sensational job to be running him as close as he is in the championship this year. But when you look at the bare facts of it this season, Dre, take the Argentina race out of the equation, where he pitted at the end of the formation lap for new tyres to change from wets to dries and finished 11th. If you take that race out of the equation, every race that Jorge Martin has finished this year, he's won.
Yeah, he's that good. He's like, he's, when he's on it, he's unstoppable. It's as simple as that. And yeah, he can win races like this that like nobody else can. He's just got more in the locker than everybody else does. But he's just been, obviously the Catalunya mistake was one thing, but being skittled out of a couple of extra rounds has really, you know, racked up the damage in terms of his title campaign, because Bezzecchi has been the guy that's, you know, been consistent, where Martin's got, you know, only one less DNFs than he does race wins, and that's done the damage for his campaign so far.
And he's now up to 14 career poles in Moto3 as well, and they've all come in the space of a year and a half. In Moto3, because I think his first pole was at the start of last year. It's an incredible run Martin is on. And he is now the championship leader once again. As I mentioned, Bezzecchi led the championship pre-race. But a costly error for him. Really, the first big mistake Bezzecchi has made this season. I mean, you could argue Le Mans final lap was a mistake from Bezzecchi, but I struggle to have too much ill will, and I struggle to criticise him too much for that, given that they were on the absolute limit, he and Martin, trying to win the race at the final corner, and he just high-sided, basically trying too hard to win the race.
Yeah.
And lost points through that. But this one, Dre, was a bit of a silly one on the final lap at Assen. It was pretty clear that Martin was going to win the race, and it didn't look as if Bezzecchi was close enough to either Canet or Bastianini to really have a dart at them going into that final left-hander at the Ramshuk or the final chicane. So it looked like fourth was about as good as Bezzecchi was going to get. He knew that there was no John McPhee behind him because he crashed a lap before, but he went down at the Mandevain corner a third of the way from the checkered flag. And in many ways, we should remember again that this guy is still in his second full season as a Moto3 rider at all. So he's going to make mistakes. But if we're treating Bezzecchi as a championship contender and as a championship favourite and a championship leader, as he was at the time, those are the kind of mistakes that you cannot afford to make.
Yeah, it's as simple as that. That's unacceptable from a title contender. That was clearly a race where he just overdid it. More than anything else, he's overdone it, and he's been made to pay as a result of this. He overdid it, and
13 points away.
Yeah, like it was an easy fourth place. It would have been an easy 13 points, and you know, a critical 13 points for the championship. But now you've given up 25 to Jorge Martin, and now like the brilliant weekend you had at Catalunya has just been completely wiped off the board. And then some, because Bezzecchi finished second that day. He didn't win, so he's now a net minus five through the last two rounds compared to Martin. So, yeah, as you said, like Bezzecchi could have easily just taken the 13 points and mitigated the damage, but as a result, he's now overdone it, crashed out, and the worst-case scenario has happened that Martin's gone on to win the race.
Yeah, and I'll be interested to see how he reacts to this at the Sachsenring next time at Bezzecchi, because it's his first real net loss to Martin in this season. I mean, he lost out in the first round in Qatar, but that was through no fault of his own. He got knocked off on the final lap, Bezzecchi. And at that point, we had no idea that he was going to be a championship frontrunner this season. We thought it was going to be between Martin, Bastianini, and Canet, the three riders who, as fate would have it, were the three on the podium last weekend at Assen. But since that first win in Argentina, he's gone on this amazing podium run. Save for Le Mans, he'd been on the podium every single race. So perhaps he's just not. Maybe this will be a learning experience for him. Maybe he'll now just come to understand that, you know, I've been on such a great podium run, but sometimes fourth might be the best I can get, and it'll be a race weekend just for getting the points on the board and getting out of there. And if he'd come out of there with 13 points, that wouldn't have been a great result by his standards this year, but he'd still be, 11 points clear of Martin still in the championship. Which basically could have bought him a couple of second places. Even if Martin wins the next couple and goes to six wins for the year, Bezzecchi would still be ahead of him in the championship. So a lot of his you know, well, I was going to say a lot of his comfort zone's gone. His entire lead is gone. And now he's got to go on the offensive and start winning again because, you know, seconds and thirds may no longer be good enough for Bezzecchi now that he trails Martin in the championship outright. And what this race has also done, what the accident of Bezzecchi in the final lap has also done, Dre, has brought Aaron Canet and Andrea Bastianini suddenly right back into it. From Canet's point of view, I mean, he's had a rubbish season, quite frankly, Aaron Canet. I mean, I know he was second in the first two races and led the championship, but there was at the end of that. But he'd gone 8th DNF, 8th, 11th DNF since then. But because of Martin's inconsistencies and because now Bezzecchi's now dropped around, the fact that he's had that podium finish has suddenly brought him right back into contention again. Canet is within a race, 24 points off lead. Aaron Canet could leave Sachsenring as the Moto3 championship leader. And given the season he's had so far, I guess he could count himself remarkably lucky to be that close. But in many ways, he should see that as a positive. He should just take this as a complete reset. And if that's the form he's on now, from Aston onwards, if he can keep that form going on, he might still win this championship.
That's a walking miracle that Canet's that close after eight races. He's not looked anything like the guy that could conceivably do this. And yeah, I completely agree with you that... You know, Canet has not been good this season. He's made many critical mistakes. His head's gone on multiple occasions. And yet, here he is on the brink of, you know, being championship leader again. He's within range of the championship again, purely through other riders' mistakes. It's becoming a bit of a war of attrition for the Moto3 title at the moment. Martin's had many DNFs. Bezzecchi's had his first, you know, real mistake of the season, you could argue. And Canet, who's been a bit of a head case all season long, all of a sudden is back in play alongside Bastianini. Like, it's slowly turning into the three guys we thought were going to lead the way for the championship this year, and the surprise of Bezzecchi, which actually, if you look at the testing, wasn't all that surprising.
Antonio in there as well. It is looking genuinely like a five-way fight at the moment in Moto3, with the five of them all taking very different routes to try and get to the championship, with Martin's serial winning and bidding it on the occasions when he's not winning. Bezzecchi's consistency, Di Gian Antonio's consistency, although always seems to be a rung further down. He's more doing it through consistent point scoring than consistent podiums. Di Gian Antonio is the only rider in Moto3 to have scored points in every race, and all of them have been in the top nine, which is why he's still up there. Bastianini's another one, like Canet, who has had a poor season by his standards, like Martin. He's had three DNFs this year, as Bastianini, and they were all from pretty strong positions as well. Obviously, Qatar, he'd have been on the podium, and Le Mans, he would have probably become a podium finisher based on what happened the lap after he crashed. And, you know, both he, like Martin, will feel, if I'd not had so many DNFs and so many poor results, I'd be right at the front of the championship as well. But yeah, he's another rider, isn't he, who his talent is unquestionable and he's kind of been let off the hook for a pretty poor first half of the year.
Exactly. Because, again, no guy has ridden it out. Jorge Martin sure has four wins. So on paper, you would say he probably is the best of the bunch right now, but has had a combination of bad luck and the one silly mistake at Catalunya has just opened the door for everybody else. Bezzecchi's been a real surprise. And then besides that, no one else has really looked that comfortable at the front of the field in Moto3 this season. Everyone else has kind of fought scraps. And now, well, again, I said, are back into play because Martin's got as many donuts as he has race wins. Bezzecchi now has a couple against his record now and a guy that was the consistent one. And now Bastianini, who has a race win to it from Catalunya, and, you know, other guys like Canet, who's, again, had flashes of his potential be shown, but has made, again, a lot of silly errors. They're all back in the mix now. So, yeah, it could become a season where whoever makes the least amount of mistakes will end up ultimately benefiting from this scenario, because as it stands right now, everyone's tripping up on each other, and it's kind of opened the door for people that probably don't deserve to be there on merit alone.
And the one we haven't mentioned, the one championship contender we haven't really talked about at length, is Fabio Di Gian Antonio, who is third in the points at the moment. He only trails his teammate and championship leader, Martin, by 14 points, even though he hasn't finished in the top two yet all season. And Di Gian Antonio is just doing this through pure consistency of just accumulating points every round. As I mentioned, he's the only guy to have done so this season. But I guess his problem in Asandre, I mean, he could have easily... I mean, he was second going in, so he really will feel he could and should have been the guy to inherit the championship lead from Bezzecchi when he crashed. But he was way too far back. Basically, DiGiantonio found himself in the wrong group early on and was unable to jump across the gap and get himself into that leading group. And you kind of feel for DiGiantonio, who's not having a bad season at all, but this run he's having of still chasing his first win, he's not going to be able to win this championship unless he breaks that duck, is he?
Exactly. He's not going to win this on second places. They're like, especially with Jorge Martin, with Jorge Martin around, who is probably going to win four or five more of these, given how incredible his pace can be on occasion. I mean, Sachsenring, like, you know, for example, no real lengthy straights to play with here. It's going to be a test of rider skill. Martin is going to be a championship on second place. It's a bit like Valentino Rossi in the MotoGP championship right now, where it's like, yeah, it's great. You're finishing second, third, fourth, that sort of ballpark area. And, you know, you're not making any major mistakes, really, and you're getting some decent results. But if you're not winning, you're not going to do the real damage to Martin, who is the favorite for this championship at the moment. So he's got to break the duck to have any real chance. And as it stands right now, he's on the outside looking in and probably will be unless he starts winning, and probably two or three more to realistically give himself a chance.
DiGiantonio is still very much in contention, but you kind of feel that he's clinging on in that championship battle whilst he's not taking victories. Here's how the race finished then, and Aston Martin, the winner by 0.6 seconds, which is a chasm of a lead in Moto3 terms, from Aaron Canet in second. That's his third podium of the year. Enea Bastianini in third. João Macia, that's a career best for him. He took fourth in the end, and the top KTM in the end, once Bezzecchi and McPhee had jumped out of the way of him. So shout out to him for Macia, best result in Moto 3 and fourth, and top KTM rider. Jakob Kornfeil, the sole Prustel GP bike left once Bezzecchi had crashed out, he took fifth, having been passed by Macia at the final chicane. Lorenzo Dalla Porta, that's his best result in sixth since his podium in Qatar at the opening round. On the second of the Leopard Hondas. Darren Binder, who we've barely seen at all this season, was up in seventh. So good to see him sort of back on form on the sole Red Bull KTM IO bike. Gabriel Rodrigo, of course, took his first podium last time out. He was eighth, ahead of DiGiantonio in ninth, and Marcos Ramirez in tenth. Hallelujah! First points of the season for Nicolò Bulliger in 11th.
Yay!
He finally gets on the board. His teammate Dennis Foggia was 12th. Tatsuki Suzuki 13th, the Le Mans winner Albert Arenas, who's done next to nothing since he took that win, he scored points in 14th, and Nicolò Antonelli, who of course missed the Catalunya race to injury, he returned to take the final point at Assen in 15th position. We've already outlined the championship standings to you, but just once again, Martin leads it at the moment. He has 105 points, two clear of Bezzecchi on 103. We have DiGiantonio third on 91, Bastianini fourth on 84, and Canet fifth on 81. So 24 points covers the top five. Sixth at the moment in the championship is Rodrigo, ahead of Andrea Migno, who failed to score last weekend. He crashed and finished 26th. Jakob Kornfeil is eighth in the points at the moment, ahead of Nicolò Antonelli and Marcos Ramirez, who rounds out the top 10. At the moment, outside of the top 10, the headlines were really from Macia, who, as I mentioned, took fourth. That takes him ahead of Alonso Lopez once again as they continue their battle for the Rookie of the Year in Moto 3. Next round of all three classes, of course, that's Moto GP, Moto 2, and Moto 3, is in around about a week's time, and that is the German Grand Prix at the Sachsenring. Right, now before we bring this week's podcast to an end, we will look ahead to this weekend because we have a double helping of superbikes this weekend. Both British and World Superbikes are in action. British Superbikes are in action at the newly resurfaced Knockhill Circuit in Scotland. Many kind of following the Lewis Hamilton example and saying that they're not too happy with a circuit being relayed because they feel it takes some of the character away. But anyway, it's Knockhill, so it's always going to have character because it's frigging Knockhill, for goodness sake.
So
we'll see how that goes this weekend. Really, the question going to this one, Dre, because last year's Knockhill weekend was dominated by Jake Dixon, but also dominated by rider injuries. We saw three key riders, including Leon Haslam, taken out through some pretty gruesome injuries. Can anyone stop Leon Haslam? He's going into this weekend with 5 wins in a row. And history would indicate that Kawasaki's go well here too. We've seen the Kawasaki's go well when Shaky Byrne used to ride them before he switched to Ducatis. And of course, Jake Dixon last season. Knockhill always tends to produce excitement because of how close it is, how short it is. It's a bit of a go-kart track in many respects. But can anyone stop Haslam's winning streak, do you think?
Dixon might be the only one going around. I mean, if Dixon is going well, that means Kawasaki is going well, and that means Haslam will probably be in contention. And
because we'll never know whether Haslam could have beaten Dixon last year.
Exactly, because injuries and all that. So yeah, like this is going to be interesting to see if Dixon's form from 2017 holds up this year, given it was his groundbreaking double victory there, and Haslam didn't race here last year. So who knows where Haslam's going to fit into this? So I mean, it should be as competitive a round as we've had all season in theory, but we'll have to wait and see. I mean, like the way it's going right now, Haslam looks practically unstoppable at the moment. He's ridiculous. He's having won 5 straight going into this, and this is a track on paper where Kawasaki should do well. So yeah, this could be a problem.
Yeah, we'll wait and see on that. It's going to be close and competitive, as I mentioned, around Knockhill. It's a very short, like less than a minute around the circuit at Knockhill, so it's going to be close all weekend. I mean, that's certainly the thoughts of Danny Buckadoo, says it's going to be, quote, ridiculously close this weekend. So we shall see. We're kind of getting to that stage of the season, aren't we, where the showdown picture is starting to take shape. All eyes on those riders outside the top six, like the Honda riders, who are just getting back from injuries and will now be looking for a clear run through to the showdown. Christian Iden, another one who's had his injuries early in the season. Now is the time of the season where the rounds are going to start following thick and fast. Of course, we have Thruxton to come. We have the summer rounds at Brands Hatch and Cadwell to come before the showdown six are cut off post Silverstone. So, now is the time to really, if you're going to make a run and try and get yourself in the top six and more to the point, stay injury free, now is the time where it has to start. And this was really where Dixon's run to the showdown started last year, wasn't it? So keep a close eye on this top six this weekend, because it might well start to take shape once Knockhill is all said and done. The championship fight in World Superbikes took shape ages ago. Jonathan Rea is going to win it. But in terms of this weekend, Ray, Misano is a race weekend that even in the peak Kawasaki dominance years, i.e. last year, Misano tends to throw up the odd surprise.
Yeah, we all saw it last year. Michael Vandermark was a massive contender to win the Grand Prix, and then Vandermark very tire fell off the rim of about a dozen or so laps to go, ending his early charge. And of course, we had Chaz Davis and Jonathan Rea fight to the basically penultimate corner, and then Jonathan accidentally but very accurately runs over Chaz's back, as you do, giving Tom Sykes the easiest win of his Grand Prix career. And of course, let's not forget race two, Marco Melandri getting his first win back in World Superbikes on the Ducati, and Jordi Torres, who could have easily had a podium on the day if it wasn't for his MVs, his BMWs, the electronics failing. Yeah, so it was the BMW conked out on him. Of all times for the BMW electronics to conk out, that one, yeah. Of course. Yeah. The one where Jordi's running second. So Misano had a bit of a knack of throwing a cat amongst the pigeons last year. So who knows if that'll happen again, or Jonathan Rea wins both races and makes us all look stupid. Who knows?
Probably, yeah. we will wait and see. There are a few stories, of course, going into this weekend that we want to keep an eye on. A lot of people have suggested, and we can't unfortunately bring you any of these stories if they do break, because as I say, we're recording this on the Wednesday, but there is some suggestions, in particular from Eugene Laverty, that some rider announcements may be imminent and may take place at Misano for 2019. Yeah. So if that happens, you'll know about it before you've already heard it on this podcast. And if you're asking why we haven't spoken about it, that is why. But yeah, we shall see. Because Tom Sykes is a rider whose future is up in the air. We don't know where he's going next year. And as Dre mentioned, he won the first race last year in, well, very fortuitous circumstances. I was going to say slightly, but it was a very lucky win the final lap, which he started in fourth and ended in first. But we'll see where he lands. Jonathan Rea is clearly the favourite, but we shall see how it goes. Yamaha will no doubt fancy their chances, given how competitive they were last year with last year's R1, and they're in much stronger position this year to compete. So Misano could well be a very entertaining weekend. Whatever does happen, enjoy the World Superbikes while you can, because the next round isn't for another 2 months after this. So enjoy it while you can, before the 2 and a bit month summer break in World Superbikes comes into effect. What we also get this weekend, Joe, we might as well mention this while we've got the time, is of course this weekend sees, unlike Laguna Seca, the return of the Super Sport round, Super Sport classes, and of course Super Sport 300, where rounds are running out in both classes. In World Super Sport, we have only what, 3 rounds to go after this. Portimao, Magny-Cours, and Qatar, I believe. Or I'm not sure. I don't think they go to Argentina, so it might be 4 rounds. Of course, Super Sport 300, there are only 3 rounds to go because they only go to the European rounds, and there are only 3 of those left. So, starting with the Super Sport 300 class, we might well be talking at the end of this weekend of Ana Carrasco either being on the verge of winning the title outright, or this might well be one of the last chances for her closest rivals to really close that gap down on her.
Right. Exactly. And the way it's going right now, I mean, the 300 class, Carrasco looks like she's the class of the field at the moment. If maybe not winning like she was at Imola, but still in the mix, in contention, you know, where she needs to be right now. She's not dropping off those leading groups, which is always a good sign. Misano, again, should be close, so that's going to be very interesting to see how that turns out. Super Sport 300, anyone's... 600, I should say. Anyone's guess. Probably Jules Cazale? Maybe? I'm starting to feel like this might be the season Jules Cazale finally puts it all together. We'll have to wait and see, but I'm starting to get the hunch that Cazale might start turning the screw soon. So we'll have to wait and see, but... In Super Sport right now, who knows? I mentioned it before. There's 5 dudes who can win races at the moment, and we don't know which one we're going to get going into every weekend. And that's what makes it so great at the moment.
Yeah, Super Sport 300 at the moment, 23 points covers the top 4 in the 300 class. Carrasco leads Sanchez by 20 points, with Grunwald a point further back on his KTM, and Daru on the Kawasaki 400 is a further 2 points behind Grunwald. It looks like it's going to be between those 4 for the championship, and it may well take greater shape this weekend, as I say, given that there are only 3 rounds to go. In the Super Sport 600 class, it's Cortese leading Cluzel by 2 points, with Krumenacker a further 15 back. The rider I'm really keeping an eye on, Dre, this weekend is the 4th man in this, Lucas Mayas, who hasn't won now since the opening round of the season in Phillip Island, and hasn't been on the podium since the round after that in Thailand when he got Krumenacker at the final corner. Mahias has been in pretty average form since that point, and yes, he might have won at Imola, but he's the rider. If anyone's going to get dropped out of this championship equation, Mahias looks the most precarious, doesn't he? So he of the 4 who are in contention is probably in most need of a big result.
I'd say so. It's starting to slip away from Lucas, and he needs to do something about it quickly. Otherwise, he's going to end up just being out of touch compared to everyone else in Super Sport right now. It looks like it's starting to break out with Cortese and Clazelby in the class of the field. Krumenacker just hasn't been as good as he was a couple of rounds ago. So, yeah, Mahias has got work to do, and he needs to start finding it now. Like I said, he's running out of rounds to make it, and the way it's going, he could be missing out pretty soon. He needs to get some results going, and quickly.
Yeah, I mean, as Henry Chapman has added in the chat, just to confirm, the SSP class do race at the Argentine round, if that round does go to happen, at Villicum later this year. That's mid-October. At the circuit that is currently being constructed out in Argentina. So following this weekend at Misano, there will be 4 races to go in the Super Sport class. And given that Mahias is already 20 back, if he doesn't close that gap this weekend, it will be out of his hands at the end of this weekend. He might well be in a position where 4 wins wouldn't even win in the championship. So a big weekend coming up for Lucas Mayas this weekend. Whatever happens, we will bring you it all next week here on Bike Life on episode 68 of Bike Life here on Motorsport 101. Looking back on World Superbikes, and indeed all the other classes in the Superbike paddock at Misano, and as well BSB at Knockhill as we head into the summer, with these rounds coming thick and fast across MotoGP back next weekend at the Saxon Ring 2. We'll bring you it all next week here on Bike Live. As we mentioned earlier on in the show, episode 149 of Motorsport 101, just one short of 150, comes next week, Dre. And yeah, a doubleheader this weekend, IndyCar in action, as well as Formula 1 at Silverstone. But most excitedly for our dear listeners, you're back.
I am indeed. Well, we'll be back on this one, probably drunk on football. Yeah. By the time we get to Monday, probably still shouting, "It's going home" via Badil and Skinner.
Yeah, but Skinner's coming home.
Hopefully. Please, England, don't f*** this up.
Yeah, don't go all England on us.
No, exactly. Like, do not do what you used to do. But yes, doubleheader this weekend. The British Grand Prix, kind of a big deal, that one. The one that we really kind of all want to see someone else besides Hamilton win, maybe. Probably not. But hey, you know, a guy can dream, right? So yeah, the British Grand Prix, we're bound to get some thrilling stuff in Formula 2 as well down there. And maybe, who knows, we might finally get the Russell versus Norris dogfight that I think Johnny Herbert's been waiting for with half his trousers on the ground. Also, as mentioned, IndyCar as well. We have the Iowa 300 in Iowa, a Joseph Newgarden would completely dominated last year, led an IndyCar record 282 out of 300 laps last season. But it's also a track that Ryan Hunter-Reay has had three wins around in the past. He always goes well around here, and he's now becoming a true title contender in his own right as well. So given the way the championship's been playing up at the moment, thanks, Henry, for correcting me. It was 2016. Helio won in 2017. Spider-Man got to climb the fence again. Good reference, Henry. Thanks for the catch. Yeah, quite right. A big doubleheader coming up, this weekend with the British Grand Prix in Iowa. And I'll be back for it. As mentioned, probably drunk on football for episode 149 next week.
Yeah, and once again, we mentioned this on last week's podcast. Any of you have any ideas as to what you want to hear on episode 150 of Motorsport 101, then get them to us. Facebook.com/Motorsport101. If you want to tweet us your ideas, Motorsport_101 is our Twitter handle. Make sure you give us a follow on there. On YouTube, it's youtube.com/Motorsport101. Our website is Motorsport101.com. And if you want to back us on Patreon and earn yourself early access to both of our weekly shows, either by getting your podcasts early or by listening live, back us on Patreon, patreon.com/motorsport101. If you back us at the $5 level, you get the early access. $10 backing earns you access to our Discord server and all the hilarity that comes with that, including listening to our podcast live. So so do back us on there. We appreciate each and every one of your support. It does mean a lot. As I mentioned, we're back next week for episode 68 here on Motorsport 101's Bike Live, looking back on the Knockhill BSP round and the Misano World Superbike round. All that's left to say between now and then is, come on, England! We'll see you next week.
Yes!